last time we talked, it was ozone. And after ozone, you, as you just a moment ago mentioned, you immediately set out to go to China. This was not your first trip to China, was it?
No, I think the really interesting thing was that it was my second trip, because the first time I went to China, it was one thing, and the second time I went to China, it was another thing. It was like going to a slightly different country, not a totally different country, but a country that was changing. And I thought, the second time that I went, this has to be written about, because anything in the process of change or transition is interesting to a writer, I think.
But you did write a little bit about your first trip.
I wrote a short book. I wrote a short book called Sailing Through China, which was just an expanded version of the article that I wrote, which was going down the Yangtze River. It was a very, very enjoyable trip. I went with 30 millionaires, and I thought, this has to be captured for posterity, 30 millionaires in Mao's China, you know, China, the people running around, the Chinese were running around with blue suits, and the people that I was with all had mink coats and, you know, Homburg hats. They were very well heeled. So it was an interesting sideshow, let's say, but it wasn't anything like the trip that I had.
Which your first trip was more or less an organized event.
Yes, first trip was a tour, and the second one was one that I organized myself.
I think it's interesting how you traveled on these trains through Asia, through the Soviet Union, keeping your notes and trying to keep your anonymity. And yet you had some close calls, didn't you, in these railroad cars?
Yeah, a lot of people, if I travel anonymously in a place, people always recommend my books to me. I think that's a good sign, that they say, you should read this, Paul Theroux, it's very good. If you reveal yourself as a writer, then I think that you are making a mistake, because you suddenly become the object of interest and people start asking you questions. You become the spokesman or the authority on something. And that shouldn't be the case. Other people are much more interesting than I am. And I think that you have to be anonymous to observe what's going on in a place.
What did they think you were doing with that notepad of yours?
I told them I was a geography teacher, I think. I usually invent an occupation. When I was traveling around England, I said I was a publisher. That's a mistake, I discovered. Well, it's a very boring occupation to be a publisher, but sometimes people say, well, I'm writing a book, so they want you to publish it. If you say you're a geography teacher, that sort of kills a conversation stone dead. And you can preserve this way of seeing, I think, so that people start talking about themselves instead of asking you questions about yourself.
Why did you decide to make this an exclusive rail journey?
Railways go everywhere in China. I think that, with the exception of Tibet, you can get anywhere in China on the train. It's the way that the Chinese themselves travel. And it's really important, I think, going to China to get off the beaten track, get off the tourist track, which is generally taking a plane to a place and then a bus, you know, the tourist bus. But the Chinese, when they go places, they go second class on the train. And they go enormous distances. They bring food, they bring chickens, they bring their children, and they sit down and they travel just the way people do all over the world, which is they colonize a compartment. They go in and they spit seeds on the floor and they spill noodles and they eat, they talk, they play cards, they gamble, they sing, they play the radio. And if you're a traveler with them, you can easily talk to them. You find that they're very candid, very, very polite.
That was startling as I was writing the Iron Rooster, that the Chinese traveled so much, because somehow the view of China is that still of a closed society where people cannot travel or have to get permission to go from one province to another.
That's very interesting you should say that, because the current feeling in China is that people ought to travel, and the government doesn't exactly encourage people to travel, but it released people from their jobs so that they could travel. And prior to 1983, the Chinese didn't travel at all. Really, it wasn't until 85 or 86 that they began traveling in large numbers. The first time I was in China, they couldn't travel. You met people in Shanghai who had never been up the Yangtze, or people in Peking who had never been to Harbin. You know, not their sort of overnight railway journeys. But people needed a special passport to travel. This restriction was lifted. The same thing happened to the Soviet Union, that the Soviets are now able to travel much more freely than they were previously. And now that the Chinese have been allowed to travel, they really go all over the country. It's not expensive for the Chinese to travel. I mean, it's very cheap. They travel at a very small fraction of what it cost me to go, for example, because being a foreigner, I pay more. All foreigners pay more in China.
Of course, the amenities are very slim, aren't they?
Yes, I think that outside of the major cities, when you're in a hotel, you might easily think that you're in a prison, a madhouse, a hospital, or jail. I mean, it's very hard to distinguish between a hotel and a prison or an insane asylum in the small towns in China. But in the big cities, there are Hyatt and there's a Holiday Inn in Peking. I mean, some of the best hotels in the world now are in China, but they're in Canton, Shanghai, and Peking.
The tourist centers.
Yeah.
What difficulties did you have in entering China as a traveler?
The individual traveler in China doesn't have big problems, at least unless he's going to Tibet. That's a separate issue now. When I went to Tibet, it was a little over a year ago, there hadn't been any serious problems, and I was free to travel. Most people go to China on a tour, but it's not hard to go as an individual. You go to the Chinese embassy, you get a visa, you explain why you're going as an individual. You can say you're going to visit someone or that you've made your own arrangements. They would rather that you went on a tour because they can keep control of you. They don't want people wandering around the country, but people do. I did.
But you did have an escort most of the time you traveled, didn't you?
About a third of the time, I had a man, Mr. Fang, who was treating me a bit the way a governess treats a very young and irresponsible schoolboy. But in the end, he got so sick of taking trains. He said, "I've never taken so many trains in my life. I'm tired of this. Please, let's stop." I said, "Okay, stop. And we'll go our separate ways."
Of course, you did have some ground rules, though. I mean, Mr. Fang, you wanted him to sleep in another compartment.
I said, well, that my rules with being... Well, they said, "We want to send someone with you to help you." That's shorthand for keeping an eye on you. But I said, well, I don't need any help. He has to sit in another compartment. That's right, not speak to me. I don't want to give him English lessons. I don't want to eat with him. But in the end, you know, I got very fond of that man. And he told me about his life. I did give him English lessons. He gave me lessons in Chinese. And I grew to like him. I made a lot of friends in China. And even with sort of bureaucrats and officials that I hadn't expected to like very much. And that had never happened to me before.
But you do speak Chinese.
Yes, I studied it for 3 years in Singapore. I was at the University of Singapore, and just to take the edge off my boredom, I took lessons in Mandarin.
Is Mandarin the basic language?
Everyone
speaks
Mandarin.
I understand there's so many dialects that many people can't.
Well, there are a lot of languages and dialects, but there are about 60 different languages in China, from Russian, which is spoken in the far west, to... I mean, there's other Indo-European languages like Tajik, there's Mongol and Tibetan. Then there are minority languages, little the Miao people down in Yunnan, people on the Vietnamese border. They speak languages that bear no relationship to Mandarin. But Mandarin is the language that everyone's taught at school. It's the official sort of government language, and it's the language that unites the billion people there. And it's not a difficult language to learn, and even say studying for 6 or 8 months, anyone going to China should pick up some, should learn some, just to say hello, goodbye, thank you, or how do I get out of here.
Well, I've got some very vivid images of China in the reading your book, but the most vivid image was one of a country that is somewhat grungy. Is that accurate?
Grungy, scruffy, dusty. It's that, yeah. It's possible people sweep, and so a place is very bare, very bald. Streets are tidy, but they're very dirty. Everything's very dirty. It's very grubby. I was talking to a man that works for Kodak, putting up a film coating setup with $9 million worth of equipment, and he said there's so much dust in the air they couldn't get the thing going. They had to install special air conditioning. Things are very dirty. It's not that physically people are clean. The Chinese are very are physically clean, they're hygienic, but places are dirty. It's the dust, and it's the numbers of people. It's impossible for them to maintain things the way someone might like to. I mean, kitchens are nightmares, toilets are nightmares. Some of the sleeping arrangements are nightmares. One of the worst hotels I've ever stayed in my life. I mean, I'm 47 years old. I've stayed in some very bad hotels, but one of the worst, I should say the worst in my life, was in, not Tibet, on the border of Tibet and Qinghai province. I mean, it was something out of a Stephen King novel. Probably worse, maybe Edgar Allan Poe. But anyway, something well worth writing about. You see, a lot of badness, bad conditions, grunginess is a gift to a travel writer. When everything goes well, there's nothing to write about.
Yeah, I was talking to Mary Morris, who wrote a wonderful travel book.
I read her
in Mexico.
I read her book.
Nothing to Declare, I think it's called.
Nothing to Declare, parenthetically. Anyway, the subtitle was A Woman's Travels Alone.
Yeah.
And she had about three or four different love affairs in the book.
Yeah, she did. Anyway. But the interesting thing was that she wanted to travel in the way that you wanted to travel in China. She didn't want to stay at Hilton's. She wanted to stay in hammock hotels and places like that, because this to her was a learning experience and also something that she was able to put into words.
Yeah.
So that was the same with you. Although in some of the more obscure places that you visited, you didn't have much choice in terms of accommodations.
No. Often there's only one place to stay, or you're guided to a place. If you're being taken around by somebody, they say you stay there. But I found that your freedom of choice is much wider than the Chinese lead you to believe. And in fact, China's full of hippies and hitchhikers and vagabonds now, particularly Yunnan and Kunming and in the southwest. There are lots of people who used to go to Afghanistan, India, Africa. They're now in China. They've discovered colorful people and easy conditions. Even there's a little bit of smoking exotic substances and the easy life. And the Chinese don't know what to do with them because they've never seen hippies before. And they're not exactly hippies, but they're travelers in the old sense. Quite interesting people. It's quite interesting they should have found this place. Tibet had them for a while. I think that Chinese are not encouraging them in Tibet. But I'm talking about budget travelers of the freest kind do exist in China.
Now, were the Chinese open and receptive to a Caucasian traveler in their midst?
Oh, yes. I mean, the Chinese are used to seeing foreigners. On the Silk Road in Urumqi, they've been seeing European travelers since the 13th century, I mean, since Marco Polo went through. What they're not used to is travelers asking them a lot of questions about themselves. And I think that it's only recently that they began talking about the Cultural Revolution or Chairman Mao. You know, Chairman Mao is a very sort of embarrassing figure for them. So to talk about him, frankly, is a very, very new experience. That before, they kept all these thoughts to themselves. They feel very divided about him. They have divided loyalties. They respect him. They admire him. It's a bit like learning that in his last years, George Washington, you know, George Washington's last 10 or 15 years were full of huge tactical, political, and military blunders, whereas he was the founding father. But Mao is like that, kind of embarrassing. But foreigners ask about it. But foreigners are the only people who ask about Mao. And now the Chinese have begun to tell the truth about it. The truth is available in China, and they've begun to be very candid about it. I was very grateful to the people who told me the truth about the Cultural Revolution, about their feelings about Mao, about their aspirations, things they wanted, and about their lives. Very few people I've come across in the world have been so candid, with so little reason to be. I mean, they have nothing to gain by telling me the truth or being candid with me.
Now, your picture of the Chinese people on a social level, the spitting and the hacking and this sort of thing, I understand that the Japanese are like that as well. I don't know the Japanese personally, but people who have lived there say this is much the same thing. Is this an aberration, or is this something that is culturally accepted throughout the country?
I should first say that I find the Japanese inscrutable, to coin a phrase. The Chinese I don't find inscrutable. I think the Chinese are knowable, scrutable, understandable people who can be very obvious, I mean, not subtle at all. As for the spitting, there's something about, there are anti-spitting campaigns, but everyone spits, and it's not just spitting. I mean, there is a long wind-up before there's a pitch. So the noise, which I think of as the call of the East, that hoik, is probably the commonest sound in China. And it can be a fairly revolting experience, you know, going up and downstairs. Or somebody, you know, they're not ambitious spitters. They don't spit over fences. They don't hit the wall. They just, it sort of dribbles down their chin. Oh, I find, disgusting. But,
in restaurants, too.
Okay, no, but I think that my real objection to Chinese spitting is that they're not very good at it. Everyone does it, but they're not good at it. They haven't mastered it. They're not like cowboys, who you think of as pretty good at it. And Indians in India are good at it. I mean, they can project, but the Chinese are not. They have a lot to learn. Everyone does it, though.
China is still a poor country. You told me that, or you told me, I think as I read your book, you're talking to me directly, which is probably a compliment to a writer. But you said that you were never so cold in your life as in that northern stretch of China.
The northern stretch of China, you have to remember, is cold because it's in Siberia. It's part of Siberia. And the western part of China is in Afghanistan. It's the desert. China has incredible extremes of weather and landscape and food and everything else. I mean, the size of the country and the way it's situated means that you can travel from, let's say, Canton and be very warm and humid in Canton. Travel via Peking to Harbin. It would take about 3 days. It took me 3 days on the train. And when I got to Harbin, in what used to be called Manchuria, I was freezing cold. I have never been so cold. It was minus 38 centigrade. It was so cold, I didn't even want to figure it out and figure out what it was in Fahrenheit, because I knew that it was pitifully cold. But the Chinese there like it. They like the cold weather. They don't complain about it. They don't talk about it. Even in hot weather, they don't talk about it. The weather is never a subject for conversation because they've been living there. And also, Mao said, good comrades are those who go where the hardships are greater. And so there's something about hardship, austerity, that actually pleases the Chinese or seems to please them. And they think they're doing something, you know, that and they like to be hardy.
One of the world's great cuisines, of course, is Chinese cooking. How did you find the food as you rode through China over that course of a year?
I gave the Chinese cuisine mixed reviews. I had some wonderful meals. The most memorable was called tea smoked duck. It takes about 2 weeks to prepare, and so you never find it in a Chinese restaurant in the United States, but it's smoked with tea is burnt and it's smoked, and then wine is rubbed on it, then it's air dried, all this business. Very, very good. It takes 2 weeks to cook and about 5 minutes to eat. I like simple Chinese food. I like lotus roots, it's peasant food. I like dumplings. Everyone eats dumplings, and you can buy them anywhere. The sort of things that you only get in China, or that they're only really good in China. I liked the food in Hunan province, which is it's sort of central. It's where Mao came from. Changsha is the capital of Hunan. And the far west, where the Uyghur people are, it's a sort of Middle Eastern cuisine. And they are like Middle Eastern people. They're like a blend of Mongols and Afghans, when they look actually like Lebanese. Or they look like my Italian grandmother, actually, a lot of them. They don't look Chinese. They speak Mandarin, but their food is also very, very good. And some of the food is practically inedible.
The rail line ended toward the west, and you had a harrowing automobile drive to Tibet. Tell me about that.
I was one of the last people who was given permission, I think, to travel by road from the town of Golmud, where the railway ends, to Lhasa. It's about a 1,200-mile railway trip, and I was given a driver. I hired a driver. It's like hiring a rent a car, but you have to hire a driver. But the driver had only been on the road. I mean, he had his license maybe 2 or 3 years. No one in China has had a license very long, except some of the soldiers. This man was an extremely bad driver, and he was driving much too fast. He turned the car over, and it was terrifying because it was a flat, dry road, a nice sunny day, perfect conditions. And when you realize that you could be I could have been killed, you know, in perfect conditions. I felt very resentful. But some Tibetans helped us get the car back on the road. We had torn the back wheel off. We got the thing fixed. I mean, this was a real nuisance. But when we got back on the road, Mr. Fu, for that was my driver's name, couldn't drive. I mean, he had had such a shock that all he could do really was go in the back seat and sleep. Also, he said the altitude affected him. He blamed his bad driving on the altitude, 16, 17,000 foot altitude. So I drove.
Thank God.
And I thought it was one of the most pleasant things I've ever done. I don't normally do it, and I hadn't done it in China. But the Chinese, it's a military road that goes through the middle part of Tibet. And the car had a cassette machine. I was putting Mendelssohn and Mozart in the cassette, music playing, the mountains covered with snow and the sun shining through the window. I thought, this is wonderful. I could have done that for another month.
What's Tibet like?
Tibet is such a strange and wonderful place that you can't even compare it with any other country. I can't compare it with any other country I've ever seen. It's a place apart. It's not mountains. It's a plateau. So you're high all the time. And it's not, the road, I should say, is straight. It's like going through the desert, but it's the high desert. It's like, in a way, like the Altiplano in South America. But I'm comparing it, and that would probably give a misleading impression. It's a wilderness of mountain peaks, one after the other. And so there are snowy peaks at the edge of a desert. And you're always at a very high altitude. You're either 12, 13, 14,000 feet. And although I did get altitude sickness, but it was bothering me. I mean, your heart palpitates. I thought it was an unearthly and beautiful place. And the people are very friendly, too. But they know that it's strange and wonderful. It's such a foreign-looking place that even the Chinese marvel at it.
You were in China for 1 year?
Yes, off and on for a year. I went, I took 5 trips.
So you did go back to England to see your family.
I even came to the States, and I went to Hong Kong. My idea was that in the past I've often traveled in a bad-tempered way, or I've blamed the people, you know, that I've been traveling among for something that's gone wrong. And I was thinking, this time, every time I get into a bad mood or things go wrong, or if I start getting irritated, I'll leave. I'll just take a little vacation. And it worked. It was very pleasant. Also, in the course of a year, a lot of things had changed in China. The money, the economy was depressed, and there were student demonstrations. So that doing it over the course of a year, I was able to observe changes taking place.
Well, to wrap things up, Paul Theroux, I'd like to ask you if you were able to draw any broad conclusions about China and the Chinese.
I found that they were knowable, and that if you are among people for an extended period of time, even people who seem very strange, that you can understand them, and that their worries and concerns are remarkably similar to ours or to your own. That they've had a turbulent history, and that things at last are changing in the way that they would like them to change. But I think the thing that I'll come away with is the thought that they're not changing fast enough to please the Chinese, and that they would like to see things happen a lot quicker. And I suppose the Cultural Revolution marked them. Everyone thinks about it. They don't always talk about it, but they say, as far as that goes, they would like to see that never happen again in their history.
Any plans to go back? Or have you had your fill of it?
I'd like to go back to Tibet. I'd like to go to various desert regions. Not necessarily to write about, but there are several parts of China that I would like to visit again. They're the wild parts of China. I got very, very fond of traveling in the wilderness there, of going to the wild places and just sort of looking around. And I found that trains don't go everywhere, and that some of the best they're empty places, but they're places where you would be camping, I suppose, or paddling a kayak or a canoe. But
by the way, how did you get out of Tibet? The book just kind of ended there.
Oh, I flew out. I flew. I took a plane from Lhasa to Chengdu. Uninteresting. I mean, unmemorable. Chinese planes are unmemorable at best, and at worst, disastrous, nightmares. Terrible.
I think it's even worse when they crash.
Yes, that's the downside. But I think that I would advise anyone going to China to take the train, to go as far as they can, as far off the beaten track as they can, and to avoid buses, to avoid planes, and to avoid sightseeing, in a way. Sightseeing is one of the least rewarding things in China, and the people probably the most rewarding.
Walt Ruhe, another winner. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.